This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Let's talk with one of our reporters. First, we have Dan Carton with the Times of Northwest Indiana with us. He usually works out of the State House and covers, of course, the General Assembly when he's down there. And he's also covering state news of interest, the latest thing of which is the Indiana Gaming Commission. And Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, we know that this has been, of course, I guess in some cases, for some people, it's like waiting for the other shoe to drop. You've been talking about this, at least in print and online, I guess, in a way. And we've talked about it on the program before since the legislature session, because the legislators basically helped get the law through the House and through the Senate, and the governor signed it. That in turn allowed the casino here in Northwest Indiana, in Gary in particular, to be able to make that move off the water and onto land. And now it's finally official, I guess, as well as I guess the final move that they have to take for the legal sports wagering to take place around the state.
Yeah, it was a big meeting yesterday at the Gaming Commission. I went down to Indianapolis to cover it because. As you said, they're moving the Majestic Star Casino to a new site, and we're going to have legalized sports wagering in Indiana starting on Sunday. Those are both, you know, major changes to the state's gaming landscape that was made possible by House and Old Act 1015 that was approved by the General Assembly this year.
Was this a case where the Gaming Commission pretty much knew what they wanted to do? They knew that, I guess it was the last official procedure that had to be taken on both issues, not only on the moving of the casino license around from water onto land, and then, of course, making the second Majestic Star Casino license available out of state, or excuse me, out of the region, we should say, not out of state, and also to the sports wagering items.
Yeah, the Gary Casino move was fairly perfunctory by the Gaming Commission. The General Assembly set certain standards that Spectacle Entertainment, which owns the Majestic Star, had to meet in terms of its plan for the new casino, and it's either in the process of meeting those standards or already has met them. For example, the law requires a $150 million investment. Spectacle's planning to build a $300 million Hard Rock Casino, more than 2,000 gaming positions, and eventually a 200-room hotel and an attached parking garage, going to really transform that area at 94 and at 8094 and Burr Street, which right now is just a bunch of empty lots and junkyard. But Spectacle tells me that starting in September, they're planning to start cleaning up, and assuming they can get the financing worked out and sort of all the business details worked out, now that they've got all the regulatory stuff done, they want to start construction this year, late September, early October, so they can open this thing on December 31st, 2020. So, you might be able to celebrate New Year's Eve 2021 at the Hard Rock Casino in Gary.
That's very possible, and certainly the city of Gary is going to celebrate certainly a transformation of the entire area, because it's right now it's pretty sad looking. It's pretty much like you say, it's junkyards and a lot of kind of miscellaneous buildings, truck stops. That's about the only thing that's really in the area that's any real business right now that's bringing anybody to that intersection. I guess is that you can get off 8094 there at Burr and you can stop and fill up the gas tank, maybe get something to eat, but you have to share space with the truckers as they're moving through the area. So this is going to be quite an improvement for the entire region, I would imagine.
Yeah, definitely. And Gary is hoping that, if people get off and go to the casino, maybe there'll be more hotels across the street or other sort of interstate area amenities that attract, new housing, other businesses, people that want to be by the casino or related to the casino, and that develops that whole Black Oak area in a way that it hasn't seen in forever.
Now, if you will, remind us about the procedure that the Gaming Commission and the legislature, I guess, because they had to make approvals as well, too, on the sports wagering. We'll make it, I guess, 13th state in the country now for Indiana to be able to fully legalize sports wagering.
Yeah, that required a lot more work by the Gaming Commission, because the law just authorizes sports wagering to start on September 1st, pending the regulations of the Gaming Commission. So since the law was enacted in early May, the Gaming Commission has really been working pretty hard to put together these regulations. They looked at a lot of what was done in a lot of other states. They looked at best practices. They met with the casino operators and, you know, the virtual sports gaming companies to try and figure out how they wanted to run this. And they really put together some regulations that are seen as some of the best in the country because they allow a broad variety of sports wagering through a lot of means, but also, as Gaming Commissioner Sarah Tate, the executive director of the commission, said, they guarantee integrity, or they're aimed at guaranteeing integrity. There's a lot of independent oversight of what the casinos and gaming commission or the gaming company operators are doing, and it's set up that, you know, if the sports leagues figure out that some of the players are crooked or some of the games are rigged, they can let the gaming commission know and make sure that there's no bets placed on that. So it's really focused on integrity, ensuring the integrity of the wagers, so that Hoosiers are betting on the outcome of, you know, fair events.
From what you understand from the meeting there at the Gaming Commission this week, and of course I'm sure this has all been brought up certainly before, which Northwest Indiana casinos are going to be able to go live with this here when this all takes effect officially on Sunday?
Yeah, Ameristar is going to be the first in East Chicago. They're kind of doing a soft opening on Sunday, and they're going to have a more grand opening on the 5th of September. Blue Chip in Michigan City is also going to start on the 5th. Hammond Horseshoe is going to start on the 4th. And then the Majestic Star actually isn't going to do a build a in-casino sports book like these other places have with the, you know, you see the giant TVs and the couches and all the betting windows. They're going to sort of delay that until they get into their new casino in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
So they will have a sports book there, but they're going to focus on the virtual or the mobile sports betting. So they're working on agreements with mobile sports betting companies to run their mobile sports betting through the Majestic Star. And that'll be people will be able to place these sports bets on their phone. You know, we could do it during this conversation, but that'll be sort of another thing that comes online later this year, early next year, through the casinos and through some other sports betting company.
From what you understand, the people you've talked to about this here in recent weeks and months, will this basically kind of close up the off-track betting operations, or since it's going to shift things around dramatically?
No, those are the three OTBs mm-hmm. downstate are all planning to add sports betting because, you know, it's another, you know, betting on a horse race, betting on a sports game. It's the same kind of facility. So in essence, it makes the OTBs more valuable because they're a physical place where you can go and place these kinds of bets. I think the more interesting question will be how often people continue going to casinos to place sports bets once they can do it on their mobile devices. Because, you know, if it's a 20-minute drive to get to a casino, you can just do it on your phone from your couch at home, maybe you do that. On the other hand, people like the casino environment. They, you know, want to watch a game surrounded by other people watching the game. They like the big screen. You know, casinos offer often discounted food or drink, and they want to be a part of that. So it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out through the industry over the next few years.
Do you think, too, that this is just going to open up more opportunities for psychiatrists and psychologists to encourage people to be careful about their betting here? Well, you hear about these on the commercials on radio and television, how you can be able to fight the gaming mood, I suppose, or the urge to gamble and spend all your money, that this is just going to be another opportunity to be able to help fight the habit?
Yeah, that's actually a concern for the legislators who approved this. So they earmarked some of the state's sports wagering revenue that's going to come in from this for extra money to go toward gambling addiction treatment programs, things like that. Because, you know, we are going to be entering an era where people are just going to be able to pull out their phone and place a sports bet using real money. And that's, you know, makes the possibility of addiction and everything else that goes along with it a lot more likely, just because You know, right now you kind of have to get in your car and drive to a casino, and it's going to take you 20 minutes, and you have to park, and you have to walk to the thing. So you have a lot of time to reconsider what you're doing before you get in there, whereas if you're just sitting on your couch at home,
yeah,
dropping $50 on every pitch of a Cubs game, you know, you can lose a lot of money really fast.
It's not much of a gauntlet that you have to run through when you're sitting on your couch, and you can do it on the phone, I suppose, as opposed
right.
to trying to make it through the front doors of the casino or the parking lot into the front doors, maybe say. One of the other stories that you also had out there, too, in print and online in the Times, is kind of an update for us on the situation involving the school town of Munster superintendents who are no longer in office, so to speak, but it seems that their retirement pay dispute is seemingly never over. And we know that the latest now is involving the Indiana Court of Appeals. And now I guess the AG's put his 2 cents worth in. Tell us what's that all about.
Yeah, the Attorney General has been leading this effort to try and reclaim some money from these former superintendents. He alleges that they received unauthorized overpayments based on their contracts. They argue that their contracts said what they were supposed to be paid. The contracts were approved by the school board. The school board subsequently approved the payment vouchers based on those contracts, so everything was done above board. The Attorney General has a different opinion on that, and he's been trying to get that money back. He lost at the trial level in Lake County. He lost at the Court of Appeals. So now Attorney General Curtis Hill is taking this fight to the Indiana Supreme Court. He's asked the state's high court to intervene and try and order a trial to give him the chance to make the argument that these Munster superintendents should pay this retirement money back. There's no guarantee the Supreme Court's going to take the case. Right now, the precedent is the Court of Appeals ruling in favor of the superintendents, saying that, you know, everything was done in the open and everybody agreed to what was done. So Curtis Hill asked the Supreme Court to take the case. The Munster superintendents have not yet responded, but they're expected to shortly. And then we should know maybe by the end of the year if the Supreme Court's going to take the case. And if they do, they can affirm the Court of Appeals. They could strike it down. They could take the case in an entirely different direction. Or if they turn down the case, then the Court of Appeals ruling would stand, and then this situation would presumably finally be over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a situation that I think people maybe ask questions about. I'm sure you probably get it too, not only from your colleagues in the newsroom just in talking about the matter, but the Indiana Supreme Court does things their own way, and they have the option of deciding what cases they want to talk about or just refer them back, as you say, back to the court of wherever it originally came from, in this case the appellate court.
Yeah, that's one of the perks of being the state's highest court. You get to decide what you want to hear. And, you know, the Court of Appeals, it wasn't a divided opinion in any respect. It was a 3-0 ruling. They said it was pretty clear. So, you know, the Supreme Court could look at that Court of Appeals ruling and just say, well, there's really no dispute here. It's just the Attorney General, you know, crusading as he does from time to time. And they don't have to play along with it. So we'll see what happens.
Do you think that since there may or may not be a decision, if it is the court of the Indiana Supreme Court takes up the matter, that that you'll get some kind of clue before the end of the year, or is it just going to be a matter where you'll suddenly get some decision that'll come out from the clerk of the court?
Yeah, that's basically how it works. Every Monday they put out a list of all the cases that the Supreme Court has decided to hear or not to hear over the past week, and I expect. You know, if, you know, sometimes not all the justices will agree. It takes three of the five justices to agree to hear a case. So if one or two dissent from denying transfer, as it's called,
mm-hmm.
You know, there might be a way to find out what kind of thinking was going on in the room then. But usually it's just a list of cases that are accepted or denied.
Well, Dan, we'll just have to wait and find out, I suppose, and you'll wait to see what your story coming out later this year in the Times is all about. Thank you very much for spending time to go over the latest for us on this matter, and we'll see what does happen as far as the school city of Munster is concerned, as if they get their money back, if the AG is able to get this matter up before the highest court in the state. Thanks very much for being with us to talk about today.
You got it, anytime.
And we're talking with Dan Carton of the Times on stories of state government, in this case, a local story that's gone all the way, may also end up being a matter before the state's highest court. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We haven't talked with this lady for a while, and we're glad to have her back. Carol Carlson covers stories generally in the city of Gary and around the region, too, for the Post Tribune. And Carol, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Well, hi, Chris. It's good to be back.
Well, you've been covering a number of stories from Gary City Hall or related to the Gary Community Schools. Let's start first with the City Hall story, because it involves a August 17th Gary police shooting, and some family members have not been happy, and then I guess they've gotten Black Lives Matter here in Northwest Indiana up in arms about this as well, too. And one of these has been one of the stories that you've covered lately. Bring us up to date with the police shooting case we're talking about and the protesters that have come out here since that shooting.
What happened was on August 17th, in the early morning hours, police were called to the scene at, I believe it was 23rd and Vermont, mm-hmm. or Roosevelt Street, and they were called there. I believe it was for a call of shots fired. One of the callers thought it was fireworks. But when they got there, they found a couple people sitting in a car, and one of them was Rashad Cunningham. There are a lot of blanks that need to be filled in. What we do know is a Gary police officer shot and killed Rashad Cunningham, who did have a gun. But the big issue right now is the Gary police aren't talking, and neither are Gary city officials. The whole matter has been turned over to the Lake County Sheriff, which is doing the investigation, and there is no final report yet. So the details of at least the police officer's version of what happened aren't forthcoming at this point. What is forthcoming, though, is the family members and friends of Rashad Cunningham are saying that he was simply shot and killed by police for no reason.
And they really, really took it up before the Common Council, didn't they, at one of the last meetings here, really, really upset about, this is why the police department hasn't done anything and hasn't said anything, and they even got some of the council members up in arms, too, didn't they?
Yeah, they filled nearly half the room at the city council meeting, and they had to sit for a couple hours for the council to go through its business, so they were pretty steamed by the time they did get to speak. And their comments probably had some weight with the city council, but there was not much response because, again, they don't have the details of what happened, and this Lake County Sheriff is actually doing the investigation. So they couldn't provide any answers because they don't have any answers to provide to the family.
And I guess they even got Ron Brewer, the council president, upset enough that he was going to push for having some information released here soon. And, I mean, I guess the 911 call tape, I think, is what he was pushing for.
That's right. So is the Post Tribune. Another reporter has actually filed a Freedom of Information request for that tape, and I believe Ron Brewer asked for the tape as well.
Mm-hmm.
The Post Tribune did receive a very, very abbreviated version of the dispatch call. It simply was two people. The first was a woman, and she said, "I think I hear fireworks in that vicinity." The second one was a man who said he heard shots fired.
Uh-huh. One of the things I know that you mentioned in your story is to remind the readers online and in print about how the Gary Police Department procedures are in matters like this. I guess because it's come down to the fact that there's no video out there.
Yeah, unfortunately, Gary police officers do not have dash cams in their squad cars, and they do not wear body cameras. We're told that it's because the city doesn't have money to afford such items. So that makes it difficult when you're trying to investigate, get at the truth, find out what happened.
Does the fact that the city of Gary has had to work with the Department of Justice in matters before, does that make any difference? Does that make things better?
It should, but whether it doesn't seem to have had much effect in this particular case, I'm not real familiar with what the city was doing. They did get a Department of Justice grant to be a participant in this one program, but I'm not that familiar with what they were doing with that program. Mm-hmm. I know it did involve police and interaction with the community.
Now, what does Black Lives Matter Northwest Indiana have to say about all this? They've certainly, they were probably there at the Common, had representatives at the Common Council meeting when this all came up.
They would like to see a citizen advisory committee to investigate such shooting. And they say so far that hasn't happened. I guess there was the mayor, Karen Freeman Wilson, they said did create a committee, but it did not include as many citizens as they would have liked, and they said it did not meet their expectation of the investigative body that they wanted to see in place.
And one of the other stories that you had out recently in print online here goes back to the Common Council meeting where the latest discussion at the time was about, the information that everybody thought that they would get to see on council from a Spectacle Entertainment about the casino. And we know, of course, the end result now that the council has gone ahead and done some action on zoning. The Spectacle Entertainment people have had an opportunity to go before the Gaming Commission this week. But what was interesting was, what people had to say, and then certainly council members had to say, about how the mayor has been handling all this. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, this was on Tuesday night at a special meeting, and it was held to take to hold final approval of an ordinance governs the rezoning of Spectacle, as well as a resolution that authorized the move from Buffington Harbor to Burr Street and 29th Avenue. Back when casinos and legislation was first created in the early 2000s, 1999, the intent, of course, was to create an economic boost for cities like Gary. And the method that they did that through was the creation of what they call local development agreements. And that is where the casino operator and the city sit down, and they actually work out the terms of how the city is going to benefit, chapter and verse, really, on the money and other anything that they want to negotiate, employment, who they're going to hire. So Tuesday night, this local development agreement was what the source of the problem was. As the council was preparing to vote, there were references made to the agreement. They were not voting on the agreement, though, but there were references made. And, of course, it goes hand in hand with approval for the casino. But they did not have copies of this agreement. And they were pretty angry, and there was a lot of grumbling that this was not available to them, and they almost felt like they were voting blindly without having the details of the benefits, what the casino was going to bring to the city. So they voiced their disapproval about it, but in the end, the vote was still 9-0.
I suppose it's just a lot of harumphing, I suppose, if you want to go back to the Blazing Saddles harumph reference that was in the movie. It's certainly that was the Common Council's version of harumphing, but as you say, the action finally did take place.
Yeah, and Ron Brewer, the council president, said that this agreement will be brought before them and they will get a chance to vote on it. However, I think that's kind of like the horse left the barn and they're going to close the door. I think that the terms will already have been hashed out by that point, and I don't know if they can make changes. I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Well, I guess this will have to come back up before Gary Common Council again at some other time, and certainly the discussion's not over, even though there was action taken at this council meeting, and you'll have a chance to be able to listen in and to take a look at this info too. Have you had a chance to look at the LDA since then?
They have not produced one yet.
Oh.
We asked at yesterday's Gaming Commission meeting down in Indy, and there still wasn't one. We know a few details. Gary will get 3% of what they call the adjusted gross receipt from Spectacle. It has to be above $6.15 million, so it's expected to be. So they know how much revenue they're going to be getting. And Spectacle has agreed to hire a certain amount of minority vendors and women-based enterprises and veteran-based enterprises. And they've also agreed that if they get the license to operate the Terre Haute Casino, they will also share the adjusted gross receipts of that casino with Gary up to 10 years.
Well, we'll see what happens with all this coming about here, and certainly keep an eye on what happens in Vigo County when the voters down there decide whether they want to have gaming.
Yeah.
That's true, too. Carol Carlson has been keeping an eye on this for the Post-Tribune and been talking with us about it today. And as always, Carol, thanks, and we'll have you back soon, I hope.
Thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, we talk with Hannah Reed. She's an intern with the Post-Tribune, and she's come out with a very interesting, if not surprising, story, maybe to some, about how birth rates in Northwest Indiana seem to have changed over the last decade. Hannah, first off, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first how you got your information together and give us more about what you've discovered about birth rates and how they seem to be on the decline here in the region.
Okay, so I read a story on the Denver Post about how birth rates and fertility rate in Colorado had declined. And so I was curious about how it had declined in Indiana, both the state as a whole and Northwest directly, just to see how it affected where we are. And I went on statsindiana.org, and I found that in Indiana as a whole, the births from 2007 to 2017 were down by 7,000. So I decided to go a little bit deeper and see, you know, Lake and Porter counties, how are they doing? And so I figured out from 2007 to 2017, it was down over 1,000 births. And I just thought it was something that was super interesting, and so I wanted to talk to people in the area to see what they thought about it, or people who were childless by choice or were going to be childless by choice, what they were thinking about the whole thing.
Tell us about some of the people that you did talk to. I know one of them in particular is an important academician at IU Northwest, and Gary, the lady who's the director of Women's and Gender Studies on the Gary campus. Tell us what she had to say and why she felt that having children was not to her choice.
Right. So I talked to Dr. Foltz, the director of Women's and Gender Studies at Indiana University Northwest, and she is also childless by choice. And that was something that I didn't know even going into the interview. I originally just wanted to talk to her because she was the director of Women's and Gender Studies, and I thought maybe she would have some insight into the topic.
Right.
But she ended up telling me, you know, she was childless by choice. She's been happily divorced since the 1990s, and her reasoning behind it was just because she said at the time when she was married, her and her husband wanted to be able to travel and wanted to be able to do other things without having, you know, children to put into daycare or take care of or do that type of thing. And she did say it wasn't because she said she loves children. You know, it wasn't because she doesn't like children. It was just not something in her that she felt she needed to fulfill.
And I understand, too, you talk to some young couples, too, so it's not just some thought of some people who are mature adults. It's younger adults as well, too, I understand.
Yeah, I talked to a girl, Nikki Jones, from Dyer, and she is, I believe, 23, she said, and her fiancé, Jake, he has kids from different relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So she's going to be like a stepmother to these children, but she said she's helped raise them, and that has, in part, you know, I guess satisfied the maternal instincts that she had. And so for that reason, you know, she's saying from now on, like, kids aren't really in the picture, although she didn't think that they were in the first place, because she said in the past she never really wanted kids. She wanted to be able to travel and, like, have independence and, you know, do all that type of stuff, which you can do when you have kids, but it's a little bit more difficult. So she said that her fiance having kids, you know, has solidified her want to not have them herself. And she said at the most she'd probably be a foster parent just because she believes that the world is overpopulated already and these kids in foster care don't get the attention that they deserve, and she wants to be able to help the community but not add to the community, like physically.
I wonder, too, if it isn't also a concern that women may have, and maybe you found out in putting together your story for the Post-Tribune online and in print, that it turns out that there's maybe a bias out there against women that have children that are out there in the job market right now?
Right. So Dr. Foltz did say that, you know, sometimes women who have a family are seen as not as serious. They're seen as people who are going to need special hours so they can be with their kids at certain times, or seen as people who are going to need to leave work to go like pick up a kid when they're sick or something of that sort.
Right.
And they're seen as not wanting to put in extra hours because they have children at home, versus, you know, men who have children, that never really seems to be something that they have to deal with in the workplace. And it also is this expectation with women that Dr. Foltz said the expectation is that whether or not they have children now, they're able to have children in the future, and that means that, you know, the company's going to need to process maternity leave and find someone to take their spot. So even if women are not planning on having children, they're seen as someone who could need this time off if they do.
Is there a concern that maybe the researchers have noted, or maybe we'll find out in the future, about the fact that the birth rate drops in Indiana, and that it's going to have an impact not only on families, the size of families, but it'll have an impact on the job market as well?
I didn't see any concern about that. One of the things I did see was the fact that women are waiting later in life to have their children. Mm-hmm. So the fertility rate has gone down along with the birth rate. And what that means is the fertility rate is the rate in which women are usually expected to have children. So between like 15 and 44 is the fertility rate. And the birth rate is, you know, the number of births that are happening. And so what I saw in my research was that women were waiting until their late 30s or early 40s to have their children versus, you know, having them at like 26 or 27. Or just choosing not to have children at all, which decreases both the fertility and the birth rate.
So do you see that there may be, although it maybe seem flippant to say so, that there are pros and cons in waiting before having children?
Yeah, I talked to Dr. Foltz about pros and cons. And one of the pros that she noted was, you know, you can have economic stability, mm-hmm. and not have to worry about, you know, spending money on a child or saving for a child education, or, you know, putting money into them, as well as being able to focus on your job and like go forward in your profession and achieve goals that are not impossible to do if you have children, but do seem a little bit more difficult. And so like there are also cons in waiting, though, because, you know, Dr. Foltz said most of the cons have to do with health complications, and the fact that it's more difficult to physically have a child without complications as women age, just because, you know, when you're waiting, your body at 26 is a lot different than your body at 42. So it's not like it's impossible, but there are different health complications.
That sounds like a lot of interesting and maybe to some people alarming facts that have come out as a result of the study that you did in your research that you've done, as well as the story that's out there in the Post Tribune online and in print. And let me ask Hannah, since you're a reporter intern, at least you're getting into the field of journalism, what did your editors think about the idea you probably had to pitch to them about this and the story that's come out?
Yes. Yeah, so as an intern, I kind of try to pitch stories that I think are, you know, I take them from national news and I kind of pull them to Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I think I was really excited to pitch this idea just because I thought it was a really exciting topic to look into, and my editor seemed excited to have it. So yeah, it got a lot of positive feedback.
That's good to hear. Well, Hannah, thank you for sharing your information with us and the story that you put out there in the Post Tribune in print and online concerning the decline of birth rates in Northwest Indiana, and the research that in the comments you got locally as well, too, from folks that had some very definite viewpoints about it. And we hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Hannah Reed is an intern for the Post Tribune. Well, the Ravinia concert season is going to be ending before too long, and Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson had to attend some of the concerts, and she's been able to tell us more about her reaction, her impression of what she's had a chance to watch and see and listen to.
Step out the front door like a ghost into a fog where no one notices the contrast of white on white.
The summer concert season is going strong, and about 68 miles up I-94, that's evidenced by the turnout at Ravinia Festival in Highland Park, Illinois. Counting Crows at Ravinia on June 29th had people on their feet at various points through the 18-song set list that included two encores. Singer, piano player Adam Duritz sounded very much like the way he did in the 90s. And his T-shirt that he was wearing that said, quote, "This is as social as I get," end quote, was particularly funny.
Round here, we always stand up straight.
Songs the band performed included the opening song, Hard Candy, and the more well-known songs toward the bottom of the list, Round Here, Mrs. Jones, and A Long December. And going into those songs, Duritz relayed a conversation he had with his girlfriend in which she asked him why he hadn't been doing certain older songs in concert. He said his response to her was laziness. It was a show definitely worth attending. The audience were on their feet much of the time dancing throughout the concert. Sunday, August 5th, was Ringo Starr and the All-Star Band with the Beach Boys, who opened the show on time, taking the stage at 7 p.m. with their hits, including Surfin' Safari, Catch a Wave, Surfin' USA, Surfer Girl, Don't Worry Baby. Then they announced they were going into their Hot Rod songs, playing 409, Little Deuce Coupe, Get Around. Then they went into The Warmth of the Sun. Sloop, John B., and Wouldn't It Be Nice. They engaged the audience to help them sing Help Me Rhonda, which they did. John Stamos also played drums and guitar with the band. Early on in the show, he bowed down to Brian Wilson. Wilson waved him off in a joking manner. The atmosphere of the place was like a summer beach party, with many people dressed in festive Hawaiian shirts and dancing like it was the 1960s all over again. There were also several community beach balls being hit around the lawn. Toward the end of their set, the Beach Boys played Barbara Ann, Kokomo, and Fun, Fun, Fun. At around 9 o'clock, Ringo Starr and his All-Star Band took the stage. Ringo introduced the band and explained, as he does in all the All-Star Band shows that I've seen, that every member of the band is a star in their own right. Isn't that the truth? This is reportedly the 14th variation of the All-Star Band, and it includes Toto's Steve Lukather, Santana's Greg Raleigh, Men at Work's Colin Hay, Hamish Stewart of the Average White Band, multi-instrumentalist Warren Ham, and drummer Greg Bissonette. The 79-year-old former Beatle was in excellent shape, to the point where you'd be amazed that his age is what it is. When he introduced some of the songs, he referred to, quote, "that other band that I was in." And Beatles songs Ringo performed included Don't Pass Me By, Yellow Submarine.
In the town where I was born, lived a man who sailed to sea. And he told us of his life in the land of submarines.
I Want to Be Your Man, and With a Little Help from My Friends. Ringo sang his own songs, It Don't Come Easy, Photograph, and Anthem. Steve Lukather of Toto led his band's hits, Rosanna and Hold the Line. Greg Raleigh of Santana led the All-Star Band in Evil Ways, Black Magic Woman, Gypsy Queen, and Oye Como Va. Hamish Stewart played Average White Band's Pick Up the Pieces, and Colin Hay of Men at Work fronted his band's hits, Down Under and Who Can It Be Now. Acts still coming to Ravinia include Sting, Chicago, Nickelback, Pentatonix, The Mighty AOR with American Authors, Queen Latifah and Common, Steely Dan, Kesha, Sarah McLachlan, and Mary J. Blige, and a whole host of classical music concerts. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
Once again, Purdue University Northwest is going to bring in for the next series of Sinai Forum speakers starting this fall some very notable people, people we know every day from the news, in particular in the political world, it turns out. And to tell us more about it, we have the executive director of the Sinai Forum, Leslie Plesak. Leslie, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Chris. I always enjoy talking to you, and I'm really excited about the season that we just announced this past Monday.
That's right. There's some great speakers that are going to be coming to Northwest Indiana, in particular to not only the Northwest Indiana campus at the Westville, but also around the region too, because I know you have to one venue that you're going to have to move around to be able to get enough seats to be able to accommodate all these people that are going to want to listen to the first speaker in particular. Everything starts out September 8th with a former White House Chief of Staff, General John Kelly. First, tell us how you were able to luckily get hold of him and have him come to be the first speaker of the series.
Yeah, so I do want to thank Blue Chip Casino Hotel and Spa because, as you mentioned, they are providing their venue for us to host General Kelly on September 8th for our opening program. We did that last year with James Comey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we choose speakers. You know, people often ask me, how do you make selections? And especially in the political world, in this divisive political climate that we're in, we are a nonpartisan organization. And so we, you know, we look at everybody, and I love getting feedback and I love getting ideas from our subscribers and talk to people all the time. But General Kelly is a person who we felt can really take an honest look at the geopolitical landscape and talk to us about how it's ever changing. If you look at not just this current administration, but how fast things change in the world. So he is going to be giving us his perspective on where we are geopolitically. And we looked at a number of different speakers. And General Kelly, he has the experience, obviously, as a retired four-star general. He has the experience as the former Secretary of Homeland Security and, of course, his most recent experience in the Trump administration. And we just felt that he was he's a great speaker. And we felt that he was a great, just a good person to open. And I know there are, you know, some people like him, some people don't. The beauty of the Sinai Forum is that we bring people together in dialogue, in conversation. He's doing, you know, a 30-minute Q&A after his presentation. And it's an opportunity to listen and learn. That's really what the forum is about.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the general speaks, coming up later on October 6th, it shows, I guess, the diversity of speakers that you have. You have Liz Murray coming in, and I understand that her talk is titled From Homeless to Harvard. That's a very interesting transition.
Right, right. So Liz Murray's story, you know, I often ask people, who's the best speaker you ever saw? And I was talking to someone who books speakers in West Lafayette, and she told me that Liz Murray was among the best that she'd ever heard. Mm-hmm. Liz Murray's story, as you mentioned, is from homeless to Harvard, and there was a Lifetime movie made out of her story, and she has a book out called Breaking Night. And Breaking Night refers to when you're in the homeless community. She actually was 15 years old after both of her parents had passed away. They were loving parents but addicted to drugs, and she found herself homeless. And she mentions, I'm reading her book right now, that she was kind of going from friend's house to friend's house, and the first time she went to a friend's house and the friend's parents wouldn't allow her to stay, she slept on the subway in New York, and she realized that she was homeless. But she also realized that her mom had died with a bunch of unrealized dreams, and she made a decision that she was going to go to high school. She finished high school in 2 years, and she received a full scholarship from the New York Times to Harvard University, and she has gone on to do amazing things in her life, and now she is the executive director and co-founder of an organization called the Arthur Project, which is a mentoring program that works with high-risk middle school youth. So her story is one that will inspire you, and also, I think, just make us kind of have a perspective on what it's like to be young like that and beat the odds, really. I mean, it's very, you know, her ability to triumph over adversity is pretty amazing.
Wow, what an interesting speaker she will be, definitely, to be sure. As well, the one following Liz Murray, that's coming up on October 27th. Alan Dershowitz is scheduled to be another in the speaker in the next Sinai Forum series. Tell us about Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, he'll be speaking on Sunday, October 27th, and all the programs take place on Sunday afternoon. Alan Dershowitz, the title of his talk is called Perspectives on Justice and Civil Liberties. And Dershowitz is probably one of the, I would say, most a prominent scholar on U.S. constitutional and criminal law. And if you watch any of the political news now, you know that he makes a lot of appearances. And I think his latest book is called The Case Against Impeaching Trump. And again, your personal politics aside, it will be a discussion about how we as a nation are often moving to trying people in the court of public opinion as opposed to really following the laws, which is, you know, something that we want to be careful about. So if you've ever seen him speak, he's very academic, but he's also humorous. And I think it will be a really interesting discussion, thought-provoking discussion on what it means to be a civil libertarian in this, you know, in this day and age. So Alan Dershowitz will join us, as you mentioned, on Sunday, October 27th.
Now, coming up in November, there is one speaker that's on the Sinai Forum's speaker schedule. That's going to be on Sunday, November 10th. It's Captain Sully Sullenberger, and his talk is entitled 208 Seconds, A Lifetime of Lessons. We know this man from his example that he is no doubt set for many, many people in the aviation industry these days.
Right, exactly. And I would say, as I'm out speaking about the forum, he probably has the most recognizable face in our lineup. People are excited to hear Captain Sullenberger speak. He is known for The Miracle on the Hudson, and of course there was a movie made where Tom Hanks played Sully, and it was produced by Clint Eastwood. But really what he's going to talk about is his lifetime of experience that allowed him to stay calm. I read it was an op-ed that he wrote in the Washington Post recently, and he said the number one question he gets asked is, how did he stay calm in that circumstance? And he will be talking about that experience. And he noted that as a leader, as the captain of that plane, had he gotten, you know, had he lost his ability to stay calm, that may have turned out very differently. So he's going to draw on his personal experience. He's also an expert in safety aviation. And in light of all that's going on, you know, with Boeing and air safety, I think it's very relevant. So I think he will be delightful, you know, interesting speaker on some, you know, serious subjects, but also how they relate to our everyday lives.
Now, coming up, the last of the series for this year, coming up on December 1st, it's entitled An Afternoon with Gloria Steinem. Another great speaker that, along with all the others, will, I'm certainly, enlighten and entertain whoever shows up.
Right. So Gloria Steinem is probably... Well, she certainly is one of the most iconic figures in the women's movement. And a lot of people, you know, think of Gloria Steinem and they think of feminism. But Gloria Steinem is much more than that. She's certainly, you know, was the co-founder of Ms. Magazine. And she has several books that she's written. But to me, she is an opportunity for women, for young women, for men, too, to really look at how this gender transition and how we're moving towards equality. And, you know, with everything that's going on, again, in our climate today, I think this is an opportunity to hear Gloria Steinem tell her story. She is a very, she's an advocate for equality in all ways. I mean, she, I was talking to my daughters, they're 26 and 23, and both of them knew of Gloria Steinem, but they didn't really know so much about her progression. And so I've encouraged both of them to be there on December 1st.
That's right.
To hear her and learn. It's the reason why young women today can do any of the things that they want to do. It's all of the women before us, you know, that have sort of paved the way. And I mean, Gloria Steinem was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I mean, that's the highest civilian honor. And, you know, she's in her early 80s, and so I think she belongs on the roster of speakers when you look at it historically for people who have changed the way we view the world. So Gloria Steinem, I'm super excited to hear her speak.
And I know that for sure there will be some limited tickets available for the first in the series. That's with General Kelly coming up on September 8th when he speaks over at the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City. But you're encouraging season tickets so that anybody can attend all of the Sinai Forum speeches coming up through the series this time around.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I have to tell you, Chris, tickets are selling so quickly. So if people are interested, the series, it's sold as a series. So the number one question I get is, can I buy a single program ticket? Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, the only single program ticket we have available because of the generosity of Blue Chip Space is for General John Kelly. And you can go to our website, which we can give that information, but you can see the single program ticket there. The other thing is, if a person is interested in hearing just one speaker, you do have the option of coming to our venue, which is the Dworkin Center on the Westville campus of Purdue Northwest, the day of the program. And if we have an empty seat, we make that available to people, but we can't guarantee it. So it's kind of, you know, you're taking a chance. But otherwise, the very best way is to secure your season series tickets as soon as possible, because they are selling really, really fast. I mean, truly, they really are.
Now, how do you get the season tickets or the opportunity, at least in the first speech with General Kelly, to be able to pick up that single ticket?
So the best way to do it is go to our website, which is PNW for Purdue Northwest, pnw.edu, and then it's /Sinai-Forum. Or if you do a search for Sinai Forum, that should come up. And on the page, we have an FAQ tab, which is frequently asked questions, and we also have our season ticket tab. So either of those will give you the ticket information. And one thing I do want to point out, which is amazing and always has been in the whole 66-year history of the Forum, is that students, both high school and college students with a valid student ID, are allowed to attend the programs free of charge. They are asked to make an RSVP for the General Kelly program, and that information is also on our website under the ticket information.
And our thanks to Dan Carton of the Times of Northwest Indiana for being on the program today, and to Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune for joining us as well, to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson for her reflection in the summer concert series at Ravinia, and to Purdue Northwest Indiana's Leslie Plesak for what we've heard here today on the Sinai Forum. Monday, we have holiday programs because it's Labor Day, so we'll be back with you live with Regionally Speaking on Tuesday.